Lawman's Debt by Alan LeMay. Darkness had set in, and the rain was falling in a steady downpour as Dale Jameson, looking like some misshapen monster out of the past in his yellow slicker and huge hat, entered the tiny cabin of saplings. Here he would stay until the hue and cry had ceased. Then, with beard grown and in the garb of a prospector, he would go west over the divide and eventually reach civilization beyond. Unknown, unsought, and unafraid. He pulled off the slicker, and from his back he unstrapped a canvas bag that was stuffed to overflowing with currency and gold. Quickly he built a fire in the tiny fireplace, put on a coffee pot, and spitted a venison steak on a stick before the leaping flames. Then, with shaking hands, he opened the canvas bag and poured a fortune out on the pine board table. It was a huge pile, and he wondered how so much money could come out of so small a bag. He had no fear of pursuit. His plan had been well made. It had been cleverly executed, and his trail had been well covered. Cashing saddle and bridle and turning his pinto loose near Las Vegas Canyon was a masterstroke. No one ever would think of him leaving his horse and going on foot to a hideout by a path no mounted posse could follow. Perhaps, even now, the two men in the bank were still bound and gagged and the alarm not yet given. Or at most, the word was being passed that the Pioneer State Bank had been robbed by one man and that a stranger by the name of Brad Kelly was suspected. Who would know that Dale Jameson, the respected son of a prosperous rancher who lived far away, had staged the daring holdup? Slowly and deliberately, Dale piled up the gleaming yellow coins. Carefully, he separated the bills into fives, tens, and twenties. There was a thick pack of $100 bills with the figure of $10,000 stamped on the band around it.
$53,740.
What a tidy sum to wrest from one institution without bloodshed and without the slightest difficulty. He had slipped through a back door in the afternoon and hid in a closet till the bank was closed, the doors locked, and the curtains drawn. Then, like an avenging demon, he appeared with handkerchief over face and gun in hand. He tied the two men in the bank hand and foot, looted the safe at his leisure, and walked quietly out the back door and away. In the whole community, only a few people knew him, and they knew him as Brad Kelly, a cowboy from the Mancos River Valley. Jap Heathcote was right. A man was a fool to work all his life when he could so easily take the proceeds of labor away from those who had less brains or smaller courage. Why should a wolf dig for roots when succulent mutton was nearby, guarded by weak and incompetent dogs? There was one fly in the ointment. The watchdog of this particular fold was neither weak nor incompetent. Dale had passed him on the street 2 weeks before the holdup, and his eyes had fallen as the keen glance of the sheriff had met his own. He had suddenly found himself facing his boyhood hero, old Bill Masters of border fame, who was his father's best friend. Frequently, Masters had come to the Texas ranch in the old days. He had bounced Dale on his knee and let him hold the big 45 that swung at his side. It was a strange coincidence that Bill Masters should be at the scene of Dale's first crime, and that this scourge of outlaws should meet his first defeat at the hands of a boy to whom he had been on a par with Robin Hood and Richard of the Lionheart. Masters looked a little older now. His shoulders were a trifle stooped. The long, sweeping mustache was a trifle grizzled, but there was the same fire in the blue eyes, and doubtless there was the same skill in the lightning hand. Yet Dale had won. He had won against this noted guardian of the law, the man who had brought grief to so many who had stood beyond the pale. Dale wished that Jap Heathcote could see him and know what he had done, that he had executed the perfect bank robbery and had committed the perfect crime. As well for Bill Masters to try and catch the lightning playing above the mountaintops as to try to bring Dale Jameson to justice. The savory aroma of coffee and broiling venison roused him from his reverie, and he arose. He turned the steak and shifted the coffee pot, shielding his face from the heat of the flames with his hand. The door had blown open. He was not nervous. He didn't turn until the coffee pot was settled where it could simmer instead of boil. Strange that the door should blow open. He must have failed to close it in his haste. Slowly, he turned. He stood staring into the round orifice of a six-gun held by a steady hand. Behind it, black and wet slicker gleamed and glistened in the firelight. Above it was a face with a long, grizzled mustache and the keenest of keen blue eyes.
Brad Kelly. I thought so.
With manacled hands, Dale lay on his cot throughout the wild night. He felt a strange comfort in the fact that Bill Masters had not recognized him. It would be easier to endure the long years of prison life if this silent man did not know the one he had taken to justice was the son of his old friend, the boy he had held on his knee. Thoughts of escape flashed through his mind, but they struggled feebly and died as he looked at this man of iron who was smoking silently as the frail shelter was battered by the wind and rain. The perfect crime and the clever escape had come to a sudden and inglorious end. This stern, relentless guardian of the law had caught him scarcely before he had counted his stolen loot. It was uncanny how quickly Dale had been gathered in. Mentally, he cursed the memory of Jap Heathcote. Dale was a fool to have been attracted and led astray by the dashing outlaw. His father had warned and pleaded and threatened and cajoled until there came a final violent quarrel when Dale left the paternal roof and went his own way. Jap Heathcote had died with a bullet between the eyes shortly after his young friend had joined him, and Dale had gone on alone.
How did you find me?
Well, there ain't many people in a county like this. A few ranchers, a few miners, a few prospectors, and a few businessmen make up the whole population. But the county has miles and miles of plains, hills, and mountains. A sheriff wouldn't amount to shucks up here unless he knew a good many things that most people wouldn't notice. Sometimes he learns secrets from prospectors and lion hunters and trappers that go to the most hidden places in the wild. Sometimes he learns something from those that are much sharper than any human. Someone tells the sheriff of a strange young man living above Las Vegas Canyon. One day, the sheriff goes up there. He sees a deer that runs on ahead and disappears. Pretty soon, it comes dashing back. Something's up ahead, either man or animal. Some jays are screaming in a clump of spruce. They settle down and then rise up again and scold. The sheriff knows there's something in that spruce that shouldn't be there. The jays tell him so. And then comes the sound of a hammer. The sheriff slips through the trees and sees a young man building a cabin. Well, that's harmless enough. So the sheriff goes away, and the young man is no part the wiser. Later, he sees the same young man in town. He looks at him, and the young man drops his eyes. He can't look the law in the face. The sheriff asks about him, and learns he is Brad Kelly, occupation unknown, supposed to be a cowboy from Mancos River Ranch. A letter from Mancos River says they don't know him. The bank is robbed by a lone man. The description tallies with Brad Kelly, who built the little cabin. Now you tell me, what's the answer?
Dale lay silent in his misery. What a child he had been when pitted against this machine of the law. How quickly the solution to his perfect crime had been solved. What a fool he was. If he ever got out of this mess, but it was too late now. He had broken the law and must pay the penalty. Once again, his thoughts turned to escape. Perhaps even yet there was a chance. Bill Masters had not recognized him. Let him get away and he'd be hard to follow. He remembered the words of Jap Heathcote.
Never turn yellow if you get caught. Keep your chin up and your mouth shut, and 10 to 1 you can crawl out even if they get you behind bars.
In early dawn, the two men left the cabin and started along the path that led down the tortuous descent into Las Vegas Canyon. The rain had ceased and the wind had gone down, but the clouds hung dark and forbidding above them. Every mountain rill and dry creek bed had become a torrent that plunged and snarled its angry way over the rocks. Coming out on the rim rock above the canyon, they paused and stared without speaking at the stupendous change that had been wrought by the few hours of heavy rain. Normally, Las Vegas River was a clear, small stream that sang and bubbled and tumbled among the boulders. Now it had risen high and was filled with mud and debris. Its dark waters dashed in a wild race for the valley below, churning the brown foam and flinging spray far into the air. Together, they slipped and slid down over wet rocks. An hour later, they reached the road at the side of the stream. It continued up the canyon to Las Vegas Dam. In a little cavern at the side of the road, they came to the sheriff's horse, which had waited patiently for him. Masters had removed the saddle and bridle and thrown his blanket over it. With Dale in the lead, the sheriff walking behind him and the horse following, they emerged from the canyon into the green valley, dotted thickly with haystacks. For 100 yards, the water was over the road. Dale looked about him for the slightest chance of escape, but saw none. If he only had his hands free, he might plunge into the stream. It was deep here, within a few feet of the road, and he might get away with a long dive and powerful swimming. On the other side was a thick grove of cottonwood trees standing in the water. The road ran straight ahead a mile or so, then it rose sharply and continued over the hills to the town. A fine, cold rain had set in, and the two men hunched shoulders and bowed heads. In spite of his desperate situation, Dale was filled with admiration for Bill Masters. Nearly 60 years old, the sheriff must be, yet no storm was too violent, no test was too severe to prevent him from going forth in the performance of his duty, preventing crime, apprehending the criminal, and enforcing the law. The institutions of established society must be worthwhile after all, when such men spent their lives upholding them. The fortune that Masters carried in the canvas bag was no more to him than so much wheat. No temptation could be great enough for this man to take one penny of it.
What's that?
The dam! It's gone out!
They were directly in the path of the unleashed flood, too far down the road now to reach the safety of the canyon walls. Trapped. The sheriff acted quickly. He turned to the horse and slapped it with the flat of his hand.
Get out! Go! He won't carry double.
Masters swiftly unlocked the handcuffs and took them from Dale's wrists.
Climb that tree. It may hold. It's every man for himself now.
Dale noted the silent fulfillment of the unwritten code of the West that required the sheriff to stay with his prisoner as they both swung into the branches of a big cottonwood. Suddenly, a wall of water burst from the mouth of the canyon a mile away. Spreading like some huge feathered fan, it gushed over the valley. The tree trembled like a reed as the flood struck. Huge trees uprooted and tossed about, swirled by them, turning end over end or riding low in the flood. A huge log struck and lodged against their tree, which shook and trembled under the blow. The sheriff pointed, and Dale's eyes followed his finger. From the mouth of the canyon burst a second wall of water. Evidently not all of the dam had given way at one time. Masters pulled off his heavy slicker and motioned to Dale to do likewise. Dale watched the widening fringe flung out over the valley. Nearer and nearer it came. Trees that had resisted the first onslaught were going down, uprooted or snapped off like toothpicks before the fury of the flood. The sheriff held out his hand. Dale gripped it hard. Masters smiled, but Dale could not answer that smile. The sheriff could laugh in the face of death, for he was going out in the performance of his duty, honest and clean. Bill Masters was a man. Dale felt that he was about to die, and he had ceased to care. He was neither nervous nor afraid. His one regret was that he could not go like Bill Masters. With a roar like the loosing of 1,000 seas, the plunging, surging mass of water was upon them. The cottonwood leaned slightly out of the perpendicular. The log was torn away and went swinging end over end into the maelstrom. For a moment, Dale hoped. The crest of the flood passed. Perhaps, after all, Then, slowly, steadily, the great tree tipped. It touched the angry water with its lower branches, paused a moment, and then, as though worn out with the long battle, darted down the stream as the last root gave way. With both arms and both legs wrapped around the branch, Dale struck the water. Even then, his hold was almost broken as the foaming flood tore by. His head came above the surface of the stream, and he opened his eyes, surprised to find himself still alive. The branch was steady for a moment, but this was no assurance for the future. He could see trees as large as this one flung about and turned over and over farther out in the stream. A whirlpool caught them. Dale was plunged beneath the surface. Something seemed to tell him to hang on, and he clung to the limb till it seemed his lungs would burst. Clung there till there was a ringing in his ears. Clung until he thought the end had come, and he had descended into the dark and fathomless pit to eternity. There was a quick heave, and he was flung a yard above the surface of the stream, still clinging to his branch. He glanced across the tree. Bill Masters was no longer there. The cottonwood was floating broadside down the river now, and Dale noticed a foot or more of seemingly still water following along behind the big trunk beneath him. Into this still place came a head. It floated a moment and then sank slowly. Scarcely realizing what he was doing, Dale reached down and grasped the long hair. Slowly he lifted, and the face of Bill Masters came into view. It was a pitiful face now, with its long, dripping mustache. It was white and drawn, and the old fire had gone out of the half-closed eyes. The cottonwood had stopped its mad whirling and was floating steadily. Dale knew that the worst of the flood was over. If he could hang on a few minutes longer, he might yet cheat the death that was reaching for him with dripping hands. Again, the tree turned. Loosing his hold, Dale dropped into the water, seized another branch with his right hand, and passed his left arm around the sheriff. He could see that they were drifting toward the shore, away from the violent middle of the stream. There was hope if Dale could hang on. A small log dashed against him, nearly causing him to lose his hold. He looked at the face beside him. The eyes were wide open now, and Dale knew the sheriff was alive and conscious. There was a surge as they sped down a little rapid, and the branch was nearly torn from Dale's grasp. The strain upon hand and arm was terrific.
Can you help me hang on?
The head moved slightly from side to side, and the eyes closed. The run down the rapid had driven the tree farther toward the shore. Slower and slower it moved. Dale was sure that the flood must be receding rapidly. Already it seemed that a thousand lakes as big as Las Vegas had swept past them. Suddenly, the tree halted. Dale's feet touched bottom. The flood had spent its force. A few minutes later, the exhausted Dale carried the limp body of the sheriff to firm ground. A hasty examination showed a cut on the head, a badly bruised wrist, and the right leg hanging limp and twisted. Cutting away the trouser leg, Dale found the limb broken above the knee. The shattered bone showed in a white lump.
Are you badly hurt?
There was no answer. The blue eyes were open and upon him, and Dale was sure that Masters was conscious. He pulled off his scarf and bound the scalp wound, wondering if putting on a wet and muddy bandage was the proper thing to do. The gleam of handcuffs in the sheriff's pocket brought him to a sudden realization of his opportunity. Dale looked about him, wondering vaguely if the coast was clear for him. Far away, two men on horses topped a hill and disappeared in a little valley as they rode toward the stream. In all the soggy wasteland that the flood had left behind it, no other living being was in sight. The words of Jap Heathcote came to Dale with double force.
Never turn yellow if you get caught. Keep your chin up and your mouth shut, and 10 to 1 you can crawl out even if they get you behind bars.
Jap Heathcote was right. Dale had kept his chin up and his mouth shut, and now he could escape after being in the hands of Bill Masters, the famous hunter of men. With shaking hands, Dale unstrapped the canvas bag which Masters had carried through the jaws of death and pulled the sheriff's gun from its holster. The blue eyes were upon him, and the old fire was returning, but there was no word and no sign from the injured man. Dale was very tired, yet the prospect of escape with the stolen fortune gave him new life and new strength. He glanced at the still swollen stream, shuddered, wondered that he had come alive and uninjured from it. Then, with long strides, he ascended the slope that bordered the valley. Again, the horsemen rode into view. They were headed far to the right, and there was no danger from them. Dale paused and looked back at Bill Masters, who was lying motionless in a pathetic heap. This relentless, merciless instrument of the law could not follow him now. As for the rest of the community, they would have enough to do in searching for their dead. Dale would get away safely with the wet, sodden loot that was strapped to his back. The sheriff moved. Slowly and painfully, he struggled to one knee and tried to drag himself over the ground. Then he sank down and lay still. Dale knew he would die there alone unless he was rescued. And who could find him amidst those miles of wreckage piled high in the wake of the flood? The horsemen were still in sight, but they were traveling rapidly and would not come within a mile of the injured sheriff. Dale reached and touched the canvas bag, now on his back again. Ahead lay comfort and plenty. Behind lay years of prison life.
Hey! We need help! Hey!
The horseman stopped. Still in the grip of an urge he could not name, Dale frantically waved his hand. Presently, he saw an answering signal, and the two men rode toward him. A moment later, he was at Bill Masters' side. The sheriff lay in a twisted heap, but his keen blue eyes were upon Dale. Dale threw the canvas bag down beside him and shoved the big .45 back in its holster. Then he held out his hands for the handcuffs and smiled into the blue eyes.
I've come back, Sheriff. I'll take my medicine, and then I go straight as long as I live.
Yeah, I thought that was what you'd do. Sometimes it's hard to go straight, son. A good many people fail when the pinch comes. But after all, it's the easy way.
He made no movement to put on the handcuffs. Dale moved him to a more comfortable position and then sat by his side till the men rode up.
Hey, Sheriff, are you hurt?
Yeah, busted leg. Put on a couple of splints and I can make it to town on a horse.
The eyes of one of the men fell on the canvas bag as he dismounted.
What's this?
The money stolen from the bank.
Great Scott, you got him, did you?
Masters nodded.
And is this the fella that...
The keen eyes of the sheriff looked into Dale's young face. It was weary and drawn and showed the strain of the past few hours.
I caught Brad Kelly and got back the money. Then the flood came and he... Well, he's out there and drowned. We'll never see Brad Kelly again. This young fella came along and saved my life at the risk of his own. Men, I want you to meet Dale Jameson, the son of the best and truest friend I ever had. And Dale's a chip off the old block. I'm proud to be numbered among his friends.
And Bill Masters, relentless scourge of the outlaw, reached out and took Dale's hand in a firm grasp. Redemption at Dry Creek by Cynthia Hasselhoff. The ragged preacher shook his head.
I had a son once, but his mother drowned him like a blind pup. Maybe it was because it was my child, or maybe it was because food was already scarce and bad winter was yet coming on. I don't know why she killed him. I stood there on the riverbank and watched her. I don't know why I didn't stop her. Maybe I figured it was hers more than mine. Maybe I figured I'd done her enough hurt without making her drag my child through the rest of her life. And maybe I was just hard as nails and didn't give a damn for her or the boy or anything else. But I cannot get shut of them. That woman holding that kicking, screaming, living baby under the cold water till it was quiet and limp. When she threw him out of the water by his heels like a big fish, I kneeled down and looked at him lying there on the white river rocks, blue as if he'd been painted. A beast has more feeling than I had for that baby. I've often looked at the faces of the men I have killed, and I have known I killed them before they could kill me. And that was enough. But I do not know why I let her drown that boy.
I wasn't going to drown my son.
I reckon not.
Preacher sat beside her.
Ain't no water in a dry creek. You have to figure another way.
I ain't thinking on killing my boy. That ain't my thought.
Oh, death be here, woman. You have some thought to draw on it here.
The woman dropped her head and said nothing. The ragged man beside her was right. Her thoughts had been that morning on death, but not to drown the boy. She had seen that morning that there was nothing but the day's worth of food left. After they ate it, there was nothing. Nothing but to die. She had come to the shade tree, looking out on a dry creek, and sat with the boy, Tom, in her arms, talking to him.
Why, back in the old country, I done some foolish things. But it were a forgiving land. I woke up one day and determined it were Marmy's birthday. I woke up determined to have her a birthday. I had heard of a birthday lately. Just a dab of an article in a yellow newspaper about a queen over in England or somewhere's a-having a birthday, and everybody a-honoring her and giving her presents for her birthday. They just picked a day to have her a birthday, which weren't her real birthday. Marmy didn't know when she was born, although she had all us children wrote down in the book. And so she never had no party. So I got the idea from that paper you could pick any day you wished and have a public birthday like that queen. And there we were, alone for the men and many days from the settlement, and I was determined to give Marmy a birthday. Well, there was Marmy with the 10 of us young'uns and Sella's 9 and 5 more children with Mary. Marmy made bread every morning in a hollowed-out log big enough for you to lay down in and stretch out. I was young and feeling big to do. I figured I'd put the little uns to gathering, and I would make Marmy a blackberry cobbler for her birthday. The berries was thick, big as your thumb. Oh, my Tom, they was pretty and good, too. I made up my cobbler and set it on the table, set it in front of Marmy with a bunch of flowers we picked. That was the first time she ever sat first I could remember. And she said she was proud. Mighty proud to have a girl could make up a cobbler so nice and wait on her ma. The little uns couldn't think nothing except eating, so she cut it and took the first bite, like I said, to be special for her birthday. Well, she chewed on that cobbler, and the piece got bigger in her mouth. No happy light came in her eyes. She looked at me so sad. "Annie, it's salt," she said. I had grabbed up a bag of salt and used it for sugar. All the picking lost. All the wood gathering lost. All the rolling out and mixing up lost. All the butter and cream and flour lost, too. And the gift plumb ruined for one misthought, and Marmy disappointed in me on top. Oh, I started to cry, and all the little ones began to cry. And suddenly, Marmy started in a laughing like music. And she hugged me up and held me and laughed. "Why, child," she said, "you give me the best gift to be needed. Oh, cobbler ain't nothing." And she began to throw that cobbler around at the children. They threw it back and at each other. We all had blackberry stains and seeds all over us, so we had to go to the spring and wash. Afterwards, we all got busy and got more berries. And Marmy made a bigger cobbler, and we ate till it hurt. Oh, it were a fat country, Tom, the old country, full of green trees and water and berries enough for 2 big cobblers. Amen.
She had rocked the boy in her arms past noon. He didn't fret, but lay against her with his black hair stuck to his small round head. She had sometimes fanned the hem of his coarse cotton shirt over his bare legs. The wind had borne against them, stirring the dry leaves that the dying tree dropped. Sometimes the sand had cut them when the wind rose hard. The woman had covered the child with her body and had turned her back away from the dry creek and looked at the house. The house stood, a ramshackled kind of thing, abandoned before they came. The wind drove against the adobe bricks, dissolving them back into their native earth, carrying them over the land. The boy's father had thrown a gringo lean-to of logs against the mud walls. He had dug a root cellar beneath it and had planted a peach orchard in the sandy land. There had been water then. But the man had seen the dry coming the second year. One morning when the woman got up, he was gone, and the horses and the steers. He had taken the gun, too. That had been months back. Annie thought he'd return. By the time she understood he would not, she had a little garden of potatoes and beans and corn besides the peach trees. There was still food in the cellar. She had trapped rabbits that came to the garden, and once she had cut the throat of a thirst-starved deer who had come to the spring. She had dressed it, and there was meat for her and the boy. She had figured to stay till she figured out what to do. The sun took the corn. The peaches never made but knobs, and the potato vines began to die. She had carried water to the vines in the morning and in the evening, and the ground drank the water so that there was barely a shadow where the water had touched it. The sun had burned hotter and higher till the beans rattled in their shells. Annie made a shade over the potato vines where she could. She carried water morning and evening. This was not a country for potatoes, but she knew potatoes, and she strove for them to live because a person could live on potatoes. The creek began to dry, and the spring became a trickle, and then a few drops. There was some to drink, but none for the garden. They ate the dying fish and the beans and the stored food, not all at once, but little by little, the woman eating less and less to feed the child. Finally, Annie decided to walk with the boy to the town. They started out, climbed the hill behind the house like the man had done, and there they sat down. Annie did not know the way from there. It was a long way, 100 miles maybe, and they didn't know anyone in the town or have any money for food. She and the boy went back to the house. They gathered berries and any nuts that they had missed along the creek. Coming home with a little firewood and a rabbit, they saw the Indians digging away at the spring, filling their dry gourds by drops, wetting their horses' muzzles. The woman and the boy slept in the brush that night. When the Indians rode away, they went home and found that the Indians had taken everything that was left, even the coffee and sugar that Annie had hoarded for the company that might one day come. Annie laughed as tears ran down her dry brown cheeks.
Sure enough, my company's done been served.
Annie looked at the ragged man beside her. Beyond him, a raven settled onto the creek bank and drank from the spring. There were other ravens walking about in the dry creek. Annie's eyes ran over the evil black birds and the man. He was tall and thin. Coarse, unkempt hair stuck out over his head. A sparse beard covered his sunken cheeks. The coat he wore was black and frayed at collar and cuffs. His elbows poked out at holes in his sleeves. The white shirt beneath his vest showed spots and stains from the red clay of this land. She remembered he'd spoken of killing his child, of killing men, of her thoughts drawing death to the place.
Are you Death?
Not Death, woman. Death is gorged on this land, but I am hungry. Fix me something to eat while I sit here in the shade a spell and think.
Did them birds come with you?
They did. They are my friends, and we cannot eat them. They have preserved my life in this lonely land by bringing me carrion morning and evening. I was well until the spring I lived by played out, and the Lord directed me to this place.
The Lord didn't direct you here if he cared about you.
Oh, hush, woman. Get my supper. Just a small corn cake.
Well, there ain't no corn, mister. Not a wormy kernel. We ate them. The only thing left is a couple of dried up potatoes. The boy and I are going to eat them. Then...
Annie looked around at the empty land. no longer even yellow beneath the drought, but sucked dry of all color.
Then I figured we'd just wait to die.
I'll take one of the potatoes.
I do not think you will. I don't know you, mister. I don't know where you come from or how you got here. And from what I've seen and heard, I do not like you. You have no call on me?
I'm the preacher.
Oh, there it is then. Just like Pa said, where there's a mouthful of food, there'll be a preacher. You're bound to be a Methodist.
Shut up. Make the supper, woman. You'll have your pay.
Oh, no, I've had my pay of all the preachers they ever was. Preachers pay with worthless scrip. Preacher prayed for my ma, and she died. Prayed for my little brothers and sisters, and they was took off too. Prayed my pa would come home. He never did. Finally, when I was left to make my way the best I could, a preacher run me out of town. I've been run out of lots of places since, but you ain't running me out of this one. This is where me and my boy and you will die, preacher.
The preacher studied the woman's face. His eyes softened. He looked into Annie's pale eyes.
Fix this up, a woman.
Annie's jaws set and her eyes flared hot hate at the preacher.
Fix all there is. We'll eat it together.
Annie carried the listless boy back to the house and laid him on the quilt-tossed bed where she could see him if he moved.
Damn.
She reached into the bin where the potatoes were stored.
Just damn. What are you doing, Annie, feeding a preacher your last morsel? Pa's rolling in his grave, if he's dead.
Annie found a potato and reached back for the other. Her fingers closed over it. Withdrawing her hand, she brushed against another.
Well, there's one apiece. Ain't that nice? Pa's spinning for sure, me even thinking that.
Annie built her little fire thoughtfully, carefully placing each small branch, building the coals on the bed of ashes.
But Ma ain't. Reckon she'd be pleased there was something for the preacher. There, preacher, this potato and the good it brings you is for her sake. Even though she was deceived, she believed. It's for her sake and not your own that I'm giving it to you. So eat hearty of the miserable thing. It is all you will get from me.
The preacher came in when the meal was prepared. His face was washed. His hair lay in place. He blessed the food, thanked the Lord for Annie's generosity, knowing Annie did not want to be generous.
Reckon your God knows that's a lie if he's God. I ain't generous to you, preacher. I just had a memory of someone. I gave you what you got for her sake.
Yes. And why did she give?
Because she was an ignorant woman who believed in things that can't be?
Maybe such things can be. Must be. I'll take the loft for my sleeping quarters.
He climbed the rawhide-tied ladder to the small room. Annie watched him with her mouth set.
Sure, you just take whatever you want. Make yourself to home.
I won't wake you when I get up. I'll be out early visiting with the Lord.
You just make sure you don't visit my bed on the way out or I'll kill you dead.
The preacher leaned over and looked down into the lower room.
What is your name, woman?
Annie. Annie Caudle. My boy is Tom.
The preacher disappeared. Still sitting at the table, Annie heard him moving things about in the little room. She looked at her child on the bed.
Well, Tom, we got us a boarder.
The next morning, when Annie crawled out of her tumbled bed, still clad in her dirty dress, she saw the preacher sitting beneath the dying tree beside the dry creek. He had taken a chair with him and sat comfortably, one leg crossed over the other, reading his Bible, looking occasionally toward heaven. The ravens perched in the tree above him. Annie and Tom walked down to get the water that had collected overnight in a pitcher left at the spring. The preacher never looked at them. His lips moved, but Annie couldn't hear any words. The boy looked at him while Annie lifted the pitcher and set an empty one in its place. Annie caught the boy's stare.
Shoot. Pray till you turn purple.
She gave the boy a little water.
Rinse it around in your mouth good before you swallow.
She watched the boy. He dutifully rinsed before he drank each mouthful she gave him. At last he looked up into Annie's face. Her eyes softened.
You're a good boy, Tom.
She gently touched his head. They walked back to the house with the pitcher. In the evening, the preacher came in with an armful of small branches.
I gathered these on my walk. They're due for the supper fire.
There ain't nothing to cook.
Look again, Annie.
The woman's lower lip thrust out.
Do it, please, Annie, for Tom's sake.
You are the crudest person I ever met, teasing me with the boy's life.
Still looking at the preacher, Annie reached into the dark, dry recesses of the bin.
There... Well, I'll swear.
She bent lower, peering into the darkness. When she straightened, she held four good-sized potatoes in her dirty hands. Annie made their supper on the hearth while the man rocked Tom. After they ate, the preacher again climbed into the loft. Annie climbed back into the unmade bed and wondered how she had missed the four potatoes until she fell asleep. The next morning, the preacher was at the dying tree beside the creek when Annie and Tom went to get the water. The ravens were gone.
Where are them old blackbirds?
They are not needed now. The Lord has released them.
The Lord? Most likely they know the water's about gone here. If I was a bird, I'd be gone too. They'll probably come back to pick our bones, though.
Annie, what has made you so sour?
Preachers.
Annie went back to the house. Each morning, the preacher was at the dying tree beside the dry creek when Annie and Tom went to get the water. Whenever she looked out, he sat with the book in his lap, tipped back in the chair against the tree. He read and prayed. Each evening, he brought a little wood for a fire. And each evening, Annie found a few potatoes she'd missed. As the woman and the child began to recover their strength, the strangeness of the day's routine began to gnaw at Annie's mind. She looked at Tom.
I know there ain't that many potatoes I missed.
She sat in the midst of the tumbled bed, which she had long before ceased to make, falling into it in exhaustion and later in the stupor of hunger.
I've a mind to tear out them boards and just see what's down there.
Annie stood up.
I'll do that. I'll prove to my own mind that there ain't no taters. Then I'll talk to that preacher.
Annie started toward the potato bin. She stopped in the middle of the dirt floor. She turned slowly toward the open door. Beyond it, the preacher sat under the dying tree beside the dry creek.
Now you'll prove it, Annie, old girl. Then where'll the food come from? He's getting them potatoes somewhere and putting them in the bin while we sleep. If I make a fuss, he'll have to stop. Then where'll Annie and Tom be?
She stood in the middle of the floor.
Come on, Tom. Let's walk out to the old garden and have us a look. Maybe them taters did make it. Maybe all that water I carried done some good. If I find he's been digging my own potatoes and feeding them to us a few at a time, I'll run his preacher's behind off this place.
Annie and Tom found no signs of digging in the burned-up garden. That evening, the preacher came again with the firewood. Annie found the potatoes that could not be there, and they all ate their fill.
Preacher, where do you reckon all them potatoes are coming from? I mean, I might have missed a few, but not all these that's been feeding us these past days.
The preacher stood up and walked toward the ladder.
The Lord, Annie.
The Lord. And why is he so generous to us, preacher?
Because you have given me a place, Annie.
I don't believe the Lord puts them potatoes in that bin.
Why not, Annie? If you plant potatoes and tend potatoes and the year is right, don't you have potatoes in the garden?
Why, sure I do. I worked it with my own hand.
Your own hand had not done too well before I came, had it, Annie? But you still have confidence in what you do and what you see, what you wrench out of the earth for yourself. Suffice it for now, God's of a mind to be generous. His way is always yea and amen. His way is always deliverance.
The preacher went up the ladder and disappeared. Annie rested her head on the table.
This is too complicated for me. Ain't nobody, including the Lord, ever been generous to Annie Cottle.
Annie lay quietly, still thinking.
Well, Marmy was generous. Better than I ever deserved.
The next morning, when Annie and Tom returned with water to the house, Annie stood in the doorway a long time and watched the preacher. Later, she brought out the bedclothes and shook out the sand and red dust. She turned the mattresses and remade the beds. When the preacher came with his firewood, the cabin was set in good order. Annie had on a clean apron. She prepared the potatoes, and they all ate till they were full.
You reckon the Lord is so good to you because you let your baby be killed and because you killed all those men, preacher? Or does he just overlook that? Is that why you pace the floor at night, seeing all them dead faces?
The preacher tipped back in his chair, resting his forearm on the table, looking at Annie.
It is the nature of God to be generous, Annie.
His eyes were direct and very soft in the firelight.
Most folks would say you deserve to burn in hell.
That is fair to say about most folks. We are all eager for justice. That is why I killed those men. I figured they deserved to die. The better way is to embrace them, consume their hate with love, reconciliation, redemption.
Shoot. Sugar candy grows on bushes. You didn't let that baby be killed for justice. You was just plain mean to the core, no matter what you tell yourself or how pretty you try to make it out.
The preacher rubbed his eyes with his thumb and ring finger.
You are right, Annie. I have been thinking on the boy. I had a deep, cold place in me. I was mean to the core. I had a curiosity about how mean I could be. I think with the boy, I found the limit of the blackness. There was nothing worse. Though there were a lot of dead men and ruined women after that.
And so God forgive you and you're good all through and through? God may, but I still think you are a sorry thing.
Good night, Annie.
He went to the loft. Annie threw herself on the quilt top.
That's what I think. He's a sorry thing. Just got religion. Religion's his disguise. He'll show his spots. A leper don't change his spots.
Annie went to sleep and dreamed of leopards and spots and the torn and bloody innocent prey they consumed. Before daylight, she sat up straight, fully awake.
I reckon we best get out of here, for he does show them spots. It just ain't safe here. We're stronger now. Maybe if we walk down the dry creek a ways, we'll get someplace. Find some help.
Annie got up. She shook the boy awake.
Tom, there's a piece of moon left. We're going to walk down the dry creek to find us a town where we can live and be safe. Now get up, son. There's some potatoes left from supper and water in the jug. Come on now.
Annie closed the door softly as she and Tom left the shack.
Hallelujah! The drought is broken. The rains have started up country. We'll see the manifestation today.
Awake then with his revelation, the preacher came eagerly down the ladder on his way to the dying tree beside the dry creek. The preacher passed the beds. The forms of the woman and the child were curled deep in the covers. He smiled. The air was already colder, he thought. He opened the door. He stood smelling the light fragrance of distant moisture. The first sparse drops hit the earth, kicking up dust, bouncing off the hardness of this land.
Get up, Annie! Get up, young Tom! Come, see gentle forgiveness!
He turned into the room. Neither form stirred. He went to Annie's bed and shook her. The piled covers dissolved beneath his hand.
Dear God!
He ran from the house toward the tree and the creek. Annie's footstep had nearly filled beside the spring. The pitcher lay on its side. Further downstream, he found another track near a small pool in the middle of the dry creek. The preacher began to run.
Annie?
Annie! The rains up country! Annie, flood!
Even as he ran, the noise of the wall of water came to him. The water wall pushed past him as he threw himself onto the bank. He ran along the edge, trying to catch the water, losing the race.
Annie!
The sound of the water absorbed his words. Still, the preacher ran. He ran, and at last he saw a small bit of color. Annie's shawl, tangled in a tree. The dry creek tumbled with water and debris from above the homestead. Creek banks of dry sand had collapsed trees, weakened by the drought, into the boiling waters. The preacher searched the tumult for the woman and child.
Annie! Annie!
He reached down to get the shawl and found the woman. The preacher caught Annie by her shoulders and pulled her from the flood onto the bank. He dragged her away from the edge.
Tom! Tom!
The preacher looked up and began to search the shore for the boy. He ran along the bank, looking at the debris, cutting his face and arms on the limbs of trees that still clung to the high banks. He stopped suddenly. The child was jammed face down in the crotch of a tree. Holding the brittle limbs, the preacher fell into the flood. He raced the raging current for the small body bobbing loose from the tree. He grabbed the boy's ankle. Then, pushing his shoulder against the tree, he lifted Tom from the fork and pulled him to his chest.
Tom! Preacher, do you have him?
The preacher handed to the boy, then used his legs to shove himself off the tree and up onto the clay bank. He rested long enough for air to enter his searing lungs. Annie held the boy, rocking him gently.
Poor Tom. So cold.
The preacher caught her shoulders.
He's blue. Give him to me, Annie.
He pushed her gently aside and began to rub the child's arms and legs.
His breath is gone, preacher. He ain't breathing. You took him from me like I knew you would from the beginning.
Annie picked up a rock and struck the preacher with her weak force on the side of the head. A small trickle of blood appeared. The preacher caught her hand and gripped it.
Hold with me, Annie. Hold with me. I ain't your enemy.
He jerked her to him.
Lord, have you brought further calamity upon this woman with whom I sojourned by slaying her son?
Then the preacher sat over the boy, holding the woman. He seemed to be listening.
No. No, of course not. By God, he ain't. Get up, Annie. We've a fight to make.
The preacher stood up. Putting the boy's body over his shoulder, he lifted the woman to her feet.
He ain't breathing. His breath is gone.
Don't say nothing now, Annie. Now ain't the time.
Inside the shack, the preacher laid the child on the bed. Annie fell beside him and caught him in her arms.
He's blue. He ain't breathing.
The preacher closed the door.
Get away, Annie. Give me your son.
The preacher waited. Annie looked up into his eyes.
He's gone.
The preacher touched her lips to silence with his fingers and took the boy from her. He held the limp body with one arm as he climbed to the loft.
Preacher, preacher, make him live. Oh, dear God, please listen to this man I've been so hard on. If he's your man, I'm sorry for all I said and thought again him.
The preacher lay the small, lifeless child on the neatly made bed. He stood looking at the boy's face, then sat down beside him. He pulled the cover over the cold body. Finally, he stretched himself on top of the child and held him.
God, I ask you this. Let this child's spirit come back to him. I ain't willing to let him go.
He held the boy, rubbing his arms. Suddenly, anger flashed in the preacher's black eyes.
Death! You come out of the shadows and show your ugly self and hear me. I recognize your work. You come again to rob, to kill, and to destroy. But you get no help from me this time. I won't let this child go. And you can't take him. I'm telling you that in Jesus' name.
The rain was gentle when the preacher came down. Annie lay asleep where she had crawled in exhaustion onto the bed. He quietly made a fire and set water on to boil while she slept. He hung the boy's small shirt over a chair back and moved it toward the fire.
Tom!
The boy stood in the preacher's spare shirt with the sleeves rolled up to disclose the child's small hands.
Your mother is worn out from all the hard times and the struggle. Why don't you take her a dry blanket and lie down beside her till she wakes up?
The boy pushed his mother's wet hair aside from her forehead and kissed her.
Marmy, wake up, Marmy. The preacher's brought us home safe.
Annie opened her eyes. She caught the boy and pulled him to her. Tears ran down her cheeks as she kissed his eyes and nose and ears and cheeks and mouth.
I figured you was digging up my own potatoes on the sly and putting them in the bin for me to find. I knew you was fooling me. I knew it, but I just wasn't sure how.
Annie, could it be that God is good? Whether a woman plants a patch of potatoes and a man digs them, or it comes some other way.
I never thought it likely.
When it came to God, Pa always said you had to wrestle everything from the hard-assed old buzzard, and even then he'd short you. Looked to me like Pa was right. After Marmy and the others died...
Annie looked at the boy as she held him, unable to let him go.
I've been wrong when I thought I was dead sure right before. Why, one time I ruined a whole blueberry cobbler taking salt for sugar. It looked just right till we bit into it, too. I ain't saying I know what you done here, Preacher. But I am saying thank you.
It all begins with that, Annie. All belief begins with that. The knowledge that you have a debt to one greater than yourself.